This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Valerie Kaler, sitting in for Julie Amacher. In this week's extended podcast version of New Classical Tracks, I talk with cellist Matt Heimovitz and pianist Christopher O'Reilly about their newest album, a 2-CD set featuring sonatas by Shostakovich, Rachmaninoff, and Prokofiev, and about their years of collaboration, the importance of trust in chamber music, and the artist's role in society. Hope you like it. Hello.
Hi, Val.
You too. Christopher Heimovitz. Let me just jump right to that.
That's good. Can we go with that?
I like please.
That. Let's switch.
Matt Heimovitz and Christopher O'Reilly. The two of you have been pals and musical collaborators for a long time now. Are you tired of telling your origin story?
No, it's actually, no, it doesn't
how
get told often enough.
How did we meet, Chris?
Oh, it was a dark and stormy night. No, actually, you know, it was what's more fun is actually the fact that before we met, we were doing similar things in different ways. Matt was playing Bach in coffee houses. And I was bringing rock via Radiohead to the concert hall. Matt's wife, Luna, was running an alternative venue in Montreal, Excentris, for a while, and I was one of the artists that they brought. And I didn't even get to meet Matt at that point, but we hooked up our manager at that time, a fellow I was using and that Matt still uses. As a result of that, our collaboration was born, and it's due to our mutual love and adoration of different musical genres, our ability and joy in working together. Our first concert date was in Billings, Montana, and they gave us the stage for 4 days, gave us a lot of Xerox time and a lot of whiteout. And what was really telling was that we had, you know, 10 or 11 hour days of, you know, nonstop rehearsal and collaboration, and that sense of time just, you know, being immaterial, and just the joy of collaboration and the joy of music making together was really right there from the first moment and continues to this day.
And instantly there was a sense of trust on stage. It's one of these things that you can't rehearse. You know, you either feel it or you don't. There's a chemistry, and having that experience with Chris, you know, where also someone is able to listen and process what you're doing and also be responsive and sort of elevate everything at all times to, you know, so that you're hearing new things in the music and discovering and hearing it in a different way. It was instantly we connected.
I think that's an interesting point that a lot of people don't consider. The safety, the comfort you need to feel when you're collaborating with someone in order to be able to take the risks that make for something spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
Are you laughing at me?
No, I'm actually. You know what's really funny was we played yesterday. We played yesterday on Classical 96 here in Toronto, before a live audience, a packed house. And a little old lady came back up to us after the concert, and she said, "You know, I've never seen a married couple interact so nicely together before." So yes, brother from another mother, or maybe, you know.
I don't know. I started the interview by calling you Christopher Heimovitz, so.
I know. It's so sweet. I'll remember that forever.
We got a review recently where they spelled my name right and they completely misspelled Chris's name. So it was really nice to see that happen because I'm always the one. Yeah, for change.
Okay, this album, wow. You recorded Troika at the beginning of, or near the beginning of 2016 before all this news about Russian interference in the presidential election. Do you guys feel like soothsayers or what?
Yes, we do. But at the same time, I think it's the distinction to be made about Troika as opposed to Shuffle Play Listen, which was, again, you know, born of our mutual interest in a wide swath of a wide variety of different musics and genres. I think Troika is distinctive in that it represents three separate generations of Russian music written in exile and in protest.
So, was the album originally more of a look what happened and what's still happening way over there in Russia, showing solidarity as artists while also showcasing this spectacular music? Or was it always about the power of solidarity in the now, right here?
Oh, it's all of that. But I think, first and foremost, just passion for this music, and it speaks to us, and we want to play it. And it takes on a whole new meaning, a whole new sense of urgency in the now and what is going on. It's so powerful to me just to come to this point in our history and be able to play this music, share it, celebrate it. Music that had to go through so much to be written down, to be heard, to make it over the border, all of that, you know, it's incredibly meaningful. And then, you know, who could possibly cook up the reality of what is happening now? I mean, it just no film could possibly have come up with this. You know, it's just too unbelievable.
And the idea of arrangements, you know, of course, we had in mind to continue along the lines of our arrangements of popular songs, but initially finding pieces to pair with these fantastic sonatas became sort of an illustration of the ethos of the record as well. You know, the Shostakovich sonata is a very deep and dark piece. And yet, to have the curtain raiser be the Eyes Wide Shut Waltz number 2 for jazz orchestra of Shostakovich has a giddy sense of celebration to it. But again, you know, still delves deep into the sort of ironic somebody likened it to, you know, sort of the Russian La Valse, you know, sort of the world is falling apart, but let's order some more champagne.
I know you guys arranged these shorter pieces together. With this Shostakovich waltz, I wondered if you, Christopher, decided, I would really like to challenge Matt here, or maybe you decided that together. Can I make an arrangement that's technically difficult, but still have it sound completely simple and sweet, not overtly, obviously difficult, like, I don't know, moto perpetuo for trumpet or whatever?
It's very interesting that you point that out, Val, because the arrangements, even since Shuffle Play Listen, I was initially credited for the arrangements, but I basically set out the scaffolding. And then when Matt and I would get together, he would find ways to overstep his, you know, capacity yet again in each subsequent arrangement, such that, you know, I don't really think there's another cellist on earth that can play any of these. So, you know, we've gone so far as to, you know, absolutely say, yes, we are both responsible for these arrangements. But Matt is the one who's always resetting the bar even higher.
There's some really bananas technical stuff happening in there for the cello. You play the melody, Matt, and Christopher is accompanying you, but Matt, you're also providing your own harmonies in these little accompaniment flourishes. Like, you play the melody with straight tones while trilling the harmonies at the same time. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's a finger twister.
Don't you kids try this at home?
I like the accompaniment in that tune, because I have this kind of indigestion, you know, going on in the waltz beat, you know.
Right. When you take over the boom chick chick, you're doing chick chick, and then there's like this little lurchy boink.
Glissando slurp, yeah.
Glissando slurp.
Yeah,
I just coined that.
Yes,
Shakespearean.
In the very thorough and fascinating liner notes for this album, you talk about how Shostakovich walked this line between artistic integrity and not painting a target on his head. Can you share a bit about that?
Well, I mean, he wanted his music heard, and it would have been banned if he had gone in certain directions. And so he had to watch his back, basically, you know, as he's composing and clothe and frame what he's doing in a palatable way to the time. And I can't even imagine doing something artistic and under those kinds of conditions. But that's what he lived through.
Shostakovich, we have this impression of a man in constant fear, and indeed he did always keep a small suitcase packed against that twilight knock at the door where he would be subsequently disappeared. But at the same time, he was quite a powerful advocate for his own music and said, "They can cut off both my arms and both my legs, and I will still compose with a pen clenched between my teeth." So there's a bravery there and a passion and a need for not only survival but transcendence.
This particular cello sonata, with all that in mind, is still a departure from the spiky, dissonant, totally charming Shostakovich that many of us are familiar with. It is so much gentler.
In writing this sonata, he was having this affair with a 20-year-old translator. And so there's all kinds of programmatic elements and autobiographical kind of elements in the piece, especially in the last movement. Supposedly the music was written for a cartoon, and it takes place in the bar room, and the guy's getting drunk and having a good time. His wife walks in, he starts running around and... She's chasing him through the bar, and you hear the barroom piano in the background. And just as he thinks he's safe, his wife walks in again and slaps him into submission. So, yeah, that's the last movement of the sonata. But
the Shostakovich third movement opens with a real quote from Beethoven's A major sonata for cello and piano, Opus 69. It's sort of the dark side version of that piece, which has great generosity, and the Shostakovich version highlights isolation, desolation.
I mean, it has the most extreme moments of bleak and total isolation, being completely alone, essentially. And also sort of heartfelt, operatic, lyrical cries out and just rich, colorful harmonies. And yeah, it was an interesting time in his life.
Jump ahead to the Prokofiev Sonata. Do you have a particular favorite moment in this sonata?
I love it from moment to moment because he just keeps on inventing these stunning, stunning melodies.
I think the moment is really 1948, which saw the composition of that sonata, the Poulenc cello sonata and the Elliot Carter cello sonata. And so in that backdrop, Prokofiev very famously said, "There is still lots of good music to be written in C major."
Now, Rachmaninoff, not a cello sonata with piano accompaniment. He was working on the Concerto No. 2 around the same time. There's a bit of overlap there, I understand.
Yes.
Can you tell me about how the conversation with Tolstoy ripped the rug out from under him, and how his subsequent retreat from composition and then therapy led to both the sonata and the concerto?
Well, Ingolf Dahl is famously credited as the hypnotist who got him over his writer's block, and people speak of the cello sonata as being overshadowed by the second concerto. I think the cello sonata is his best piece in sonata or symphonic form, bar none. And I think it really has the same kind of passionate outpouring of lyric gift and inspiration that the second concerto has going for it. I will also say the second concerto isn't nearly half as hard to play as the cello sonata. Matt and I play these three sonatas in concert, and, you know, habitually we'll get to the intermission after the Shostakovich and Prokofiev, and he'll say, "Well, my work is done."
Just along for the ride after that, huh?
That's right.
So the final three tracks on this album are covers of pop songs. Can you talk about why you wanted to end the album with this vibe and these three songs in particular?
Well, we just wanted to push it into later part of the century and early part of the 21st century. And Chris and I start our relationship, you know, straddling the various genres, and we are passionate in about music in that way. We don't sort of categorize what we're playing. And so we just started listening to Russian pop music, and my six-year-old actually helped us choose Kukushka. She's the one that's sitting on my lap when we got to that tune. Listening to it, she just said, "Encore, encore." She wanted to hear it again and again and again. So I called Chris. I said, we better do this or she'll never talk to me again.
If only for the six-year-old market.
Yeah, that's an important market. Don't slate that market. So, with Pussy Riot, that was just such a... When that story happened, I wanted to include that in some way and also pay tribute to them and support that cause. And it was very difficult to find a tune that would work for cello and piano because there's not a whole lot of melodic contour to that music. And although I do enjoy trying to emulate all kinds of timbres and have various definitions of beauty, but that was tough. But then when I encountered this tune, I shared it with Chris and we both thought that would translate really beautifully for cello and piano.
Especially as, you know, the crossover in and of itself, Punk Prayer opens with a Russian Orthodox hymn. And so at least that was our way into the piece that then devolves into screaming and thrashing that we had to approximate in various fashions. Matt has some toys and tools that he had to incorporate for that one.
Right. No, normally I'm completely acoustic. I am still acoustic, but I brought in a styrofoam cup, which I smash under the bridge to give the distortion effect of the punk element. And then I use a glass slide with my left hand on my second finger to slide around and give kind of a theremin-like pizzicato effect.
And finally, ending with The Beatles.
That was Matt's idea.
And, we couldn't not
but
do
it. But it was sort of inevitable, really. especially because, you know, we worked so hard to approximate the jet coming in for a landing at the very beginning, which Matt does so eloquently. And he really nails the guitar solo, so what more reason do you need than that?
How did the procession of events, politically world events, how did that influence how you decided to package the album and write about it and talk about it?
Well, as far as the packaging goes, I think you'll be very pleased to see the inner cover art is the famous mural on the side of a restaurant in Vilnius, Lithuania, of 45 and Putin kissing. I loved it so much I bought the T-shirt.
And those guys who created it were incredibly generous. When we approached them for the license to be able to use it on the inside cover, they gave us a break on it, and they were happy that we were going to include it in our album, and they wanted to be able to talk about our work in their social media and so on. So it was very generous of them. We're very grateful for that.
Did you have any concerns? Did anybody try and talk you out of that, or did anybody try to get you to tone it down?
Well, everybody's been, you know, sort of asking us to tone down any coloring outside of the lines of classical repertoire. So yeah. I don't think anybody, you know, shaking their fingers at us for being a little bit more politically aware, not even to say active, was going to dissuade us from this project. And in point of fact, you know, the beginning and end of this as being, you know, the straddling of three generations of protest and exile was just a great takeaway from this project. And the music speaking for itself and for the transcendence of art in dealing with contemporary society and historical and age-old problems of interaction, of citizenship and government, I think was a very, very important project to take on.
That was the extended version of my conversation with pianist Christopher O'Reilly and cellist Matt Heimovitz. Their newest album is a 2-CD set called Troika. I'm Valerie Kaler, sitting in for Julie Almacher this week. This is New Classical Tracks from APM, American Public Media.